Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the London School of Economics. As you know, we are deeply honored today on behalf of London School of Economics and on behalf of the Center for the Study of Global Governance to welcome Chief Anyoko, Emeka Anyoko, to give his public lecture to us. Indeed, this is a were it not for another sad event today, this is a very, very great day for the Commonwealth, because in a sense, the one great schism that divided the Commonwealth over the last 30 years and more ended only earlier this week. And with the news that South Africa will be applying to rejoin the Commonwealth is once again restored to its wholeness, that wholeness from which it was detracted. So it's very appropriate, and this is not designed, it's purely accident, that we have the Secretary General of the Commonwealth speaking to us today. And indeed, as many of you know, there couldn't be anybody more appropriate than Chief Anyoko to speak to us on the Commonwealth, because he has dedicated his life to the sort of building up and development of the notion of the Commonwealth Secretariat. All his life, much of his life, has been in the service of the Commonwealth, mainly in London. As you know, he graduated from Ibadan and was for a while in the diplomatic service of his country. He's a member of the Permanent Commission mission of Nigeria at the United Nations. But soon after the establishment of the Commonwealth Secretariat in London, he was pressed into service. And I will not bore you with the details of his career, because I'm sure all of you know it much better than I do. But from then on, he has, in various capacities, served the Commonwealth Secretariat. And now, of course, he is a Secretary General of the Commonwealth. I would only say one thing, that we have to reflect that when 5 years ago, when the Berlin Wall fell, many people have thought that a whole new era of global governance or global peace would inaugurate. The United Nations will come into its own, and a whole new agenda had appeared before our eyes. We are wiser. And older, 5 years on, the world is not an easy place to govern, and indeed problems of a variety unthought of before have appeared. But through all that, I think what has also happened is that the Commonwealth, which is very often neglected or sort of underemphasized, is coming into its own, because people see its value as a global association, purely voluntarily, countries have voluntarily entered into it because they want to preserve connections, however involuntary entered into in the past, they want to continue now voluntarily. It is not a military pact, it is not a trade association, it is not the regional bloc, it is not a monetary union. It is a association of sort of consenting nation states. And I think its value as a model for international governance will come into its own as from now on we develop a better Commonwealth. Anyway, I don't want to speak about this. You have a much better person to speak. So I'd call upon Chief Anyoko to speak. Thank you very much.
My Lord Chairman, I could not begin my remarks tonight without referring to today's tragic news. This is not the moment for me to pay John Smith the tribute which his lifetime of distinguished public service demands. Suffice it to say that the Commonwealth, no less than Britain, has lost a fine and talented parliamentarian from whom we have all derived much. We mourn his passing, and our thoughts will especially be with his wife and family. My Lord Chairman, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, may I say how pleased I am that I was able to accept your invitation. The London School of Economics has for nearly 100 years had an enormous influence directly and indirectly on British ideas and on its institutions. But it is not only Britain, indeed all the world has benefited from the scholarship that this great forward-looking institution has produced. Its tradition of radical thought has had a profound impact on generations of students and might even be described as proving ground for the first generation of Commonwealth leaders. The Commonwealth's connection with the LSE has been and remains particularly close. Its early reputation for looking at the world from new perspectives, for seeking solutions to problems for which traditional methods had found no answer, had a great appeal. It still does, I am pleased to say. Since the Second World War and the transition from empire to Commonwealth, scores of Commonwealth students have passed through your doors, and most of them have gone on to play prominent roles in public life, the civil service, and the universities of their own countries. In addition, the Commonwealth Secretariat and the London School of Economics have had many practical linkages, one such being the Center for the Study of the South African Economy, whose work has contributed in no small way to the Commonwealth's role in assisting the process of change, and who, I hope, will now equally play a part in the consolidation of South Africa's newfound democracy. I returned only this morning from Pretoria, where I attended the inauguration of President Nelson Mandela as the first leader of a non-racial democratic South Africa. It was, for me, an unforgettable and deeply moving occasion to see Nelson Mandela, whom I had met in far different circumstances in Portsmouth Prison in 1986, being sworn in to universal acclaim as the popularly elected leader of all South Africans. The Commonwealth was one of the several intergovernmental organizations which sent groups of observers to monitor the elections that led to this historic change in South Africa. Our group was led by one of your distinguished alumni, Michael Manley, a former Prime Minister of Jamaica and a staunch supporter of everything the Commonwealth stands for. A trenchant and internationally recognized critic of apartheid, Mr. Manley quickly established a rapport even with those who were still a little guarded about his reputation through his love of cricket. Mr. Manley's writing and legendary knowledge of the game in the Caribbean earned instant respect for him in South Africa, where sport is aching to a religion, and where renewed Commonwealth membership is perceived not merely for its economic and political benefits, but for the sporting horizons which will be opened up as a result. South Africa, as you did say, my Lord Chairman, has been an issue that has dominated the Commonwealth agenda for decades. The iniquitous system of government, apartheid, which emerged there under the euphemistic and grotesque title of separate development, was rightly opposed by the Commonwealth and everyone who believed in individual liberty and the equality and dignity of humankind. Now, however, the first ever multiracial elections have been held. Just as the Commonwealth has been able to play a significant part in the process of transition through diplomatic and technical assistance, through helping to address the issue of violence that threatened to undermine the process, and through observing the actual elections, so I hope we can also help in the great task of reconstruction. For example, we already have plans jointly with the United Nations for a donors conference later in the year to assist South Africa to meet its human resource needs in the post-apartheid era. Additionally, we are working with others to encourage the flow of inward investment. And we do all this not just because South Africa will, I trust, shortly become the Commonwealth's 51st member, but because I believe that as a multiracial and diverse association, the Commonwealth has been able to bring particular experiences and skills to the attention of a society which itself is coming to terms with its multiracialism and its diversity. That brings me to the thesis that I wish to advance in my lecture tonight. It rests on two propositions. The first is that we live in a period where many of the major challenges facing many individual nations, as well as the international community as a whole, call for a renewed commitment to multilateralism. The second proposition is that, judged by its collective principles and practical activities, the Commonwealth is increasingly becoming an effective model for that new multilateralism, and as such deserves far greater support and recognition from opinion leaders and decision makers alike. As we all know, and indeed as you reminded us a little while ago, the end of the Cold War brought many benefits. The threat of a nuclear conflagration has been much reduced, and nuclear arsenals are to be destroyed in the Ukraine. Peace has come to Cambodia and Central America, and most dramatically to South Africa and to the Middle East. There are hopes that at last a peaceful solution can be achieved in Mozambique. Peace even reigned, albeit briefly, in Afghanistan and Angola. Freedom and democracy have been on the march, not only in Eastern Europe, but across much of Africa and elsewhere. Many of us had hoped that these welcoming developments were pointers to a more profound change, that with the end of the Cold War, the threat of conflict in many parts of the world will recede, and that when conflicts did occur, the international community would act in unison to address them more effectively, most particularly through a new and expanded role for a revitalized United Nations. Such hopes were fanned by the decisive manner in which the global community cooperated in countering Iraq's invasion of Kuwait under the aegis of the United Nations. There was also a general expectation that the so-called peace dividend, that is, savings accruing from an abatement of the arms race, which both derived from and sustained the Cold War, would be channeled to meet the widespread needs of the developing world. But these expectations have been far from being fully realized. Sinister forces have emerged alongside legitimate democratic institutions since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, that symbol of repression in Europe and the marker for subsequent democratic change. Over the past 5 years, Almost every region of the world has been touched by a resurgence of intolerance. It has emerged mainly in the guise of nationalism and a demand for self-determination. Whole countries and communities have been torn apart by conflicts, fanned by intolerance based on such traits as ethnicity, religion, and language. We see one ethnic group versus another, Hindu versus Muslim, Muslim versus Muslim, Catholics versus Protestant. In several places, the conflicts have exploded in a savagery that few but the most cynical could have anticipated. It is not just the former Soviet bloc and the developing world which faces this threat of mindless violence and intolerance. Many of the industrialized nations, Britain, the United States, France, Germany, Australia, are also showing signs of increasing racial friction. Other factors are at work, but the prospect of increasing ethnic and sectarian tension in these countries is linked to the dangerous mix of falling economic fortunes and rising chauvinism. The failure to address effectively the explosion in regional and ethnic conflicts following the end of confrontation between the superpowers has demonstrated only too clearly how inadequate is the existing commitment to multilateralism. The haphazard international response to these conflicts has led unavoidably to the conclusion that the existing multilateral framework is replete with double standards. Why, for example, has the global community responded in such a slow and piecemeal fashion to the brutal civil war in Bosnia? Why is its response to the conflict in Rwanda, where tens of thousands of people have been massacred in cold blood, so desultory and hesitant? Many critics have concluded on this sort of evidence that there is one response when the interests of major powers are threatened and another for when they are not. The inability of the global community to respond with equal concern to these various conflicts is often explained on a number of grounds. It may be because there is little clarity in what the multilateral response should be, or because it is not easy to mobilize the necessary human, material, and financial resources. The point, however, is that no matter what reason is adduced for an inadequate international response to particular conflict situations, there is perhaps a deeper explanation for these failures. For true multilateralism to prevail, it needs a soul, a set of principles, universal values, if you will, that will anchor it firmly within a moral perspective. Otherwise, it remains mere rhetoric, spoken but not pursued. And it will not be dependable, for it will be accepted by some when it suits them, and will be rejected by others when it does not. That, as we all know, is no way to try to bring about order and peace in an unstable world. Genuine multilateralism is needed not only in addressing civil conflict and regional tensions and in creating global security, but also in addressing a host of other issues that illustrate the importance of global cooperation, the environment, trade, migration, drug trafficking, to name but a few. Of course, the key global mechanism for achieving such multilateralism must remain the United Nations, together with its institutions and agencies. Regional organizations such as the European Union, the Organization of African Unity, ASEAN, and the Organization of American States, as well as the international organizations with a global reach, such as the Commonwealth, have a supportive role to play in aid of the United Nations. But increasingly, as it has been amply demonstrated in respect of the environment, especially during and since the Rio Earth Summit, the non-governmental organizations have a significant practical contribution to make. Whatever the mechanism, I believe that if effective multilateralism is to be pursued, there would need to be a mindset. There would be need for a mindset. A mindset that leads policy and decision makers in government and non-governmental institutions always to recognize the common interests of our common humanity. This becomes even more important as our world grows smaller with technological advances. As Archbishop Trevor Huddleston said in an open letter to Nelson Mandela, published in The Independent only 2 days ago, and I quote him, "Our world is interdependent. The technology of instant communication brings this home to us every day. It is no longer possible for evil in one part of our world not to affect all of us who live in it." It is a formidable task, this need to instill an internationalist approach in nations. The barriers built by the sense of otherness remains formidable. It was a point graphically illustrated by Matthew Paris, who, writing in the Times last month on the contrast in the public interest between Bosnia and Rwanda, remarked on the silence over the latest atrocities in East Central Africa as follows, and I quote him, "We have plenty of news but no comment. This is not because the English have no opinions, but because they have the same opinion. They think these people are savages and there is nothing to be done about it. To save a fuss, they think that's better left unsaid." That was Matthew Paris. Until people in one part of the world stop thinking of people from another as being, and I put it quite crudely, not like us, multilateralism will never be more than a well-meaning but unenthusiastically pursued policy. But we not only need a change in mindset, we also need more effective global mechanisms at the center of which must remain the United Nations. We must therefore, in this context, contemplate how to make the United Nations a more effective instrument for international peace and security. This would involve raising a number of questions, many of which relate to the organization's charter. Should the composition of the Security Council be changed to better reflect present-day realities rather than the world as it was in 1945? Do we need a sharper definition of the UN's peace-enforcing role as distinct from its peacekeeping role? And as its responsibilities increase, how are the necessary costs to be best assured? When I talked 3 days ago with Secretary General Boutros-Ghali in Pretoria, he reminded me of the extent of increase that has happened and that has taken place in the UN peacekeeping bill. Over 5 years alone, the cost of its peacekeeping operations has jumped from $233 million in 1987 to over $3 billion now. Given the scale of these demands and the rising incidence of conflict situations, the supportive role which regional organizations can play has been recognized by, among others, the UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali himself in his Agenda for Peace. The Commonwealth also, as I mentioned earlier, has a unique role to play here. On one level, it is the United Nations in miniature, being far more than a regional organization. It is a global subsystem. In the Commonwealth, we have an organization that represents a quarter of the world's population, touching every continent and every ocean. We can claim success in the field of mediation and conflict resolution, as most recently demonstrated in Lesotho. Despite impressions which some sections of the press sometimes like to convey, the Commonwealth has been remarkably successful in promoting the principles and practice of democracy to such an extent that only 2 of 50 members are still under military rule. We're also an organization which operates on the basis of great intimacy and camaraderie. This is made possible by the informality of our organization, its minimalist structure, a common language, and a shared commitment to values such as democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. These characteristics are useful in a world where there is an increasing realization that security, democracy, and development are inextricably linked. Democracy and the rule of law promote stability. Democratic systems, by providing scope for the full participation of all the people, encourage the mobilization of the nation's energies and talents for development. And development, in turn, reinforces the power to assert freedoms. Economic progress and the spread of democracy need to proceed in parallel, the one reinforcing the other. And the Commonwealth is committed to assist both the promotion of democracy and sustainable development. The need for effective multilateralism is evident not only in the context of security issues, but also in addressing new problems of economic interdependence. We saw this in the recent GATT trade negotiations. But there are other factors, too, which more and more are limiting the freedom of individual countries to act independently. The technology revolution, which is taking place in the financial services industry, has removed any idea of national frontiers. Capital moves across borders unhindered. Nowadays, it is usually accompanied by industrial know-how. Against this background, significant shifts are taking place in the balance of economic power, thrusting forward countries, especially in the Asia-Pacific region. In the last decade and a half, we have witnessed a decline in the share of world GDP held by the United States and Western Europe, and an increase in that of Japan, China, and East and Southeast Asia. This trend seems set to continue as manufacturers, in an attempt to protect their competitive edge, relocate production in countries endowed with cheap, skilled labor and up-to-date infrastructure. Those of you with personal computers will know at first hand what I'm talking about. Parts that were once made in Japan, later were made in Taiwan, then in Hong Kong. Now they seem to come from Malaysia, Indonesia, and India. Mr. Blobby, that peculiarly British inflatable toy that so dominated the pages of this country's popular press and television during the past winter, was made in China. Soon, I am told, it could be the turn of Eastern Europe. In the world of comparative advantage, there is no political, ideological, or geographical straitjacket. The changing balance in economic power and increasing interdependence call for parallel change in the arrangements for international economic coordination. This is needed to ensure that national policies take sufficient account of their international implications. When the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed in the early 1970s, the International Monetary Fund saw its role as watchdog of the world economy somewhat recede. It is now the G7 group of leading industrial countries, which is more and more acting as a focal point for international coordination. This brings into question the issue of whether the needs of the less well-off and poor countries are adequately understood. It is not an easy world out there if countries choose or are forced to act alone. We all need each other in one form or another. We all have things to sell and we all have things to buy. But there must be rules, parameters, if you like, or else the weakest will suffer. The successful completion of the Uruguay round after so many years of stop-go negotiations is an important advance towards a system of trade based on internationally accepted regulations. The agreement enshrines a far greater commitment to multilateral rules than hitherto existed. This was why Commonwealth heads of government decided in Cyprus last October to send a Commonwealth ministerial mission around all the key capitals in the last few desperate weeks of negotiation to urge a successful and balanced conclusion to the Uruguay round. There is another issue which must be addressed, and that is aid. True, private investment has displaced government-to-government financing in several countries as an effective engine for economic development. But the flow of private funds has tended to be concentrated in those few countries whose credentials meet the requirements of international investors. The Commonwealth has broken new ground in seeking to encourage private flows when it established in 1989 a Commonwealth Equity Fund. This novel development is soon to be followed by the creation of a Commonwealth Privatization Fund, specifically designed to assist developing countries in their privatization plans by ensuring that adequate financing is available where otherwise this might not be so. Where insecurity and poverty reign, the chances of economic revival are indeed slim. Some countries, given the level of development of their human resources and infrastructure, will not in the foreseeable future attract private investment on a scale needed to lift them from poverty and despair. The Commonwealth is also able to provide high-grade technical assistance, most particularly through its multilateral fund, the Commonwealth Fund for Technical Cooperation. Despite its relatively small size, in recent years it has never disbursed more than £30 million of assistance in a year. Our work is widely recognized as being flexible, responsive, and providing value for money. It has a number of unique features. It is owned by recipient countries in the sense that they define their own priority needs, rather than having some multilateral institution defining their needs for them, normally at a great distance. From a short list of possible experts, the country itself chooses the individual who they feel can best assist. And the flow of technical expertise from a fund to which everybody makes some financial contribution is not just north to south, but also south to south. With, for example, an Indian water engineer assisting Malta with the problems it may have in safeguarding that country's water supply, or a Tanzanian accountant working in Papua New Guinea. The prospect that aid levels will increase to the UN recommended target of 0.7% of GDP does not look promising. As I mentioned earlier, any hope that part of the so-called peace dividend will be used to build up the economies of the poorest countries has not materialized. On the contrary, the reverse has taken place. Take away the strategic factor, whereby one country would offer aid to counter the influence of another, and priorities change overnight. Today, major donor countries are simply reluctant to commit new funds. As their budgets come under recessionary pressure, they are looking for ways to cut public expenditure. Aid is often the first category to be slashed. Furthermore, the demand everywhere for aid funds is on the rise, and new claimants have appeared. The Soviet Union is now a collection of new nation states as hungry for support as any freshly independent colony from the 1960s and the 1970s. And there are the Eastern European countries like Poland and Hungary, like Romania, and some, like Czechoslovakia, have multiplied and become two countries. Yugoslavia became five countries with the terrible internecine consequences which we have all been witnessing. Substantial new claimants are also emerging from the Middle East. We have seen in this development a noticeable shift in aid given. Narrower strategic interests are again rising to the fore. I need only to refer to the ease with which the newly formed European Bank for Reconstruction and Development was able to raise some £7.5 billion as its start-up capital to point in which direction Western Europe is thinking. This, I should emphasize, at a time when the International Development Association, part of the World Bank Group, is struggling for new funds. I believe that the world's major donor countries should reflect on these trends and recognize their implications. Long-term national interests are best served by approaching problems from a wider international point of view. So often, national policies are determined by short-term electoral considerations. One cannot blame them, but we need to remind the world's leaders from time to time that international security requires a longer-term vision of national interest. My Lord Chairman, I believe that in the political sphere, as in the economic, the Commonwealth has a significant contribution to make in underpinning genuine multilateralism. At a time when the global community is examining whether the institutions set up in the post-Second War period are adequate to deal with the new situation, the Commonwealth possesses certain basic strengths which I believe should serve the global pursuit of effective multilateralism well. The fact that the Commonwealth has no charter means we can discuss whatever issues suits time and place. Freed as we are from institutional constraint, we are able to take initiatives that would be impossible in more formal organizations. All this, in essence, highlights the informality and flexibility of the Commonwealth. These characteristics, I think, are its greatest strengths. We do not take a vote. We act together by consensus. Consensus allows for differences of opinion without damaging the association, and for the Commonwealth to change and adapt without being impeded by tortuous institutional constraints. At the core of Commonwealth consensus is a belief in a common humanity and in global interdependence. It includes also belief in multilateralism rather than unilateralism, and in genuine internationalism against narrow nationalism. The Commonwealth regards the diversity of its membership and its wide experience of plural societies as assets to be employed in working to build bridges across the divides, not only of race, but also of ethnicity and creed. By making a virtue of diversity and pluralism, the Commonwealth seeks to provide the answer to those who advocate any kind of racism or intolerant national or religious fundamentalism. In the Commonwealth, we have shown how a group of 50 diverse countries, loosely held together, can act in concert on a manageable scale for the benefit not just of each other, but for the rest of the world. I cannot say we have always found the perfect solution, or that our work fully answers the problems of our members. But our multilateral approach, I believe, is a valuable template that can be used elsewhere. It shows, my Lord Chairman, the way towards a more tolerant world, a world in which peace and security can be pursued, respecting the due balance between national sovereignty and international responsibility. May I wish, Lord Desai, and the other organizers of your seminar tomorrow, great success. And I look forward to hearing your conclusions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a most scintillating lecture. I should all agree we've had a kind of magisterial performance today here. Very kindly, our guests, our honored guests, have agreed to answer questions. Are there any questions to you? Yes.
Why wasn't the organization much more vocal in its opposition to the fact that democratic elections were annulled in Nigeria? And secondly, in the light of recent developments in South Africa, what steps are you currently taking to nudge the dictatorship along democratic lines?
Well, the Commonwealth, not only a number of individual governments, but particularly myself, I spoke out on a number of occasions in very strong criticism of the annulment of the elections in Nigeria. And I also spoke out when that was compounded by the re-emergence of military rule. In terms of what the Commonwealth will be doing to nudge the leadership in Nigeria towards return to civilian elected government, I can tell you that I have had a series of conversations with the Nigerian leadership, including as recently as yesterday morning in Johannesburg. And I believe, too, that at the last Commonwealth Summit in Limassol, in Cyprus, that a number of leaders did make their views very clear on the matter, and that the Nigerian government is not unaware of those views to the extent that it is now taking steps to see that it returns the country as speedily as possible to a civilian elected government.
Gentlemen there.
As a former student of the LSE, could I say how much I was pleased to hear Chief Anyaoku's illuminating address? I'd like to raise 2 points briefly. First of all, is the Secretariat considering various steps to popularize the Commonwealth . Regrettably, the media don't seem to attach so much importance to it as one would like, and the public, therefore, seem to be unaware of its great achievements and its significance. The second point I'd like to raise is, could consideration be given, perhaps, to attracting, again, back to the Commonwealth, those areas in the world and those countries which at one time were ruled by Britain, and I'm thinking of countries in Southeast Asia and also in the Middle East and perhaps elsewhere, because the Commonwealth, as one could see, expands the area of international understanding and and cooperation. And from that point of view, it serves a great good purpose.
Thank you. With regard to your first question, we in the Secretariat are acutely aware of the need to project as much as possible the activities of the Commonwealth to the press, including in particular the press in this country, through whom the public, the general public in this country, will become more aware of what goes on under the aegis of the Commonwealth. We have a fairly regular publication in the form of our current, designed to achieve that purpose. And whenever situations or developments occur which require comment by the Commonwealth, we do make such comments and send them out to all the news media and so on. I think at the end of the day, and this was implicit in what I was saying, there needs to be a greater awareness, but of course there's a limit, or there are limits to how far one can go. You can produce the material, but at the end of the day, it's for the media to use them. I mean, somebody pointed out to me in the plane coming back from South Africa this morning, how the discussions about the return of possible return or expected return of South Africa to the Commonwealth have been taking on, and the extent to which it was covered in the media here was far, far limited and not in the sense of projecting the value of such a return both to South Africa and to the Commonwealth itself. Be a mutual, something of a mutual benefit. So we are doing our best, but I think that the situation is getting progressively better. Here, for example, I would like to acknowledge with grateful thanks the debate in the House of Lords the other day on the Commonwealth and its future role. I think it was probably the first time, but our Lord Chairman can correct me, when part of the British Parliament discussed the Commonwealth for as long as about 5 hours, I think it was. And that was something very important, but I didn't see reports of that and much of that in the press. Again, what can one do? But we'll go on. We wouldn't give up. I think we are progressively bettering the situation, and I hope very much that as time goes on, there will be greater awareness and greater projection of the Commonwealth in the media here. As to your second question, at the moment the Commonwealth has 50 members. Speculation at this stage, it's perhaps more than speculation in the case of South Africa, we will soon become 51. It is possible that we will become 52, 53 before too long. And at the end of the day, it is really up to countries to apply for membership. One country which was ruled in part by Britain, namely Cameroon, applied for membership some years ago, and at the last summit, heads of government decided in principle to admit Cameroon to Commonwealth membership, provided that its current program of full democratization and human rights respect is successfully concluded. So I don't think that the door has been shut against anyone. But at the same time, I don't think that one can speak of a deliberate recruitment program by the Commonwealth.
Gentlemen there.
Going to remain a passive spectator or do something positive about this? What are your plans about this?
Well, As you know, Rwanda is not in the Commonwealth. It doesn't mean that the Commonwealth has no interest in doing whatever it can to contribute to addressing the tragic developments in Rwanda. But over this last weekend, I had discussions on Rwanda or discussions about Rwanda, both with the UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali, whose direct responsibility it is, and with the Secretary General of the OAU, Salim Salim, whose responsibility it also is. And I talked with them, as well as with the President of Tanzania, because Tanzania, a Commonwealth country, is being subjected to a great deal of suffering as a result of what's happening in Rwanda. So I think in terms of encouraging action from behind, I have done so. In fact, I also spoke with the current president of the UN's Security Council, who happens to be a Nigerian, Ibrahim Gambare. And as you know, in the last 36 hours or so, the UN Secretary General has now put forward a proposal that there should be about 5,000 to 5,500 troops to be sent to Rwanda, which would be a significant increase from the very a paltry UN presence at the moment, which is less than 400. So something I hope can develop from this, but it is essentially not a Commonwealth direct responsibility, and the Commonwealth can only support from the sidelines.
I'll take one more question, the gentleman there. Yes.
If I may start from the list of examples you gave, I believe that Francophone community, that the only provincial government it has admitted to membership is Quebec. Quebec, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick. But that was done as a result of discussion and agreement with Ottawa, I seem to recall. But of course, the French-speaking community, La Francophonie, is a different animal from the Commonwealth. Its emphasis is on culture. It's essentially a cultural association. Hence, its collective machinery, which is situated in Paris, the ACCT, Agence Coopération Culturelle et Technique, is so called. The Commonwealth is association, a political association, as you rightly said, of sovereign nations. I think that until the concept of sovereignty becomes further diluted or further modified, I think we now live in an age where the concept of sovereignty is no longer as sacred as it used to be. I think you now have a growing scope of international intervention in matters that would years ago have been ruled out of court for international intervention on grounds of sovereignty. Because of the progressive emergence of what I would describe as a new global humanitarian order, I think until that process goes much further down the path, it would not be, I'm quite sure, to the liking of the Commonwealth governments to modify the sovereign basis of membership.
I think I'd like to thank you, Anya, again.
again very, very much, both for his lecture and for answering questions. And I'd like to extend an invitation to all of you. We have a reception upstairs in the same common room. Do please join us, where you can informally meet our chief guest and other people. Thank you very much again for coming, and thank you, sir, very much for scintillating.